The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. My guest today is Maggie Kurth-Baker, the science editor at BoingBoing.net, one of the most widely read blogs in the U.S. Her work has appeared in magazines such as Discover, Popular Science, and New Scientist, and on websites including National Geographic News and Scientific American. Her new book, Before the Lights Go Out, tells the story of America's energy systems, where they came from, how they work, and how they'll have to change to meet the needs of a new generation. Thanks for being here, Maggie.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by talking about the history of energy, because it looks like we've been using pretty much the same system since Edison.
In a lot of ways, yeah. In a lot of ways, it's also changed. The original electric grids, and grids are really, I should probably clarify what I mean when I'm talking about a grid, because it's not necessarily an intuitive idea. Grids are more than just one line that connects your house to a power plant. It's this whole network, and it's a loop. It has to connect power plants to utility customers and then back around to the power plants again. I've been kind of describing it to people as being a lot like a lazy river at a water park, where you have to have everything constantly going in a circle or the entire ride breaks down. So these grids have existed in ways that are very similar to their original form since the late 1800s. How they've changed, though, is that, for one thing, they've become national. Up until the 1970s, there were still a lot of places that were their own little separate islands. So a town in the U.S. wouldn't be connected to anything else. They would have to provide all of their electricity for themselves. It would all be done on this closed-loop system. And today, they're connected everywhere from coast to coast and on into Canada as well.
Well, maybe tell us about Appleton, because I really like that story.
Yes. Appleton, Wisconsin, ends up being surprisingly important to the history of electricity. Thomas Edison was building the world's first centralized electric grid in New York City. But at the same time, there was this guy named H.J. Rogers, who was just a random businessman from Appleton, Wisconsin. He owned a paper mill. And he got talked into buying the rights to license and use Edison technology in Appleton by an Edison salesman who he went on a fishing trip with during that summer. And so he came back from this fishing trip convinced that he was going to beat Edison to the punch and that Appleton was going to get its grid set up before Edison could set up his. And they came really, really close. It was, I believe, they were 2 weeks behind Edison. So they were the second centralized electric grid in the entire world. And they were the first hydroelectric power plant in the entire world. And I think that they're particularly important, though, because Appleton was the first place that you had somebody who was not Thomas Edison, didn't have Thomas Edison's team of geniuses working with him, try to take this technology and put it to use in the real world.
So now Appleton was, it turned out to have some problems, correct?
It had a few. It had a few, because H.J. Rogers had bought this technology, but he didn't buy anybody to tell him how to use it. And that ended up mattering a lot because grids are harder to use and harder to manage than he thought they were. I told you, you know, the grid's like a lazy river at a water park. And the same way as a lazy river, it kind of has to function within these specific parameters. So it has to, the electricity flowing along, it has to move along at a constant speed, which is analogous to frequency. And it has to move along at a constant depth, and that's analogous to voltage. And the way that you manage that constant speed and constant depth is by maintaining an almost perfect balance between electric supply and electric demand. And H.J. Rogers didn't really know this. So when he got this grid set up the first time, he tried to save money by having the same water wheel that powered his paper mill power his electric generator. And that turned out to be a problem because the paper mill had a lot of demand. And at the time, H.G. Rogers was his only customer for the electricity. So when the paper mill was running at full capacity, it was producing way more electricity than that little grid actually needed. And it ended up burning out all these light bulbs throughout H.J. Rogers' mansion. And those light bulbs at the time were $36 a pop.
And hence they all went broke.
Yes. Well, it was partly a technology thing. But even if he had been technologically competent, there's a good chance he still would have gone broke. This was the first time that American businessmen ran into these issues where they had to learn how to deal with businesses that required you to build a massive infrastructure before you could even get going. This was something that came up with electricity. It's something that came up with long-distance rail as well. And people had no idea how to manage that kind of business. It's really surprising to think about. Like, this was something that just completely blew my mind because I'd never even considered it before. But they had to build all this expensive infrastructure. And at the time, light bulbs were the only things you could use electricity for. And it was impossible to make back the money that you'd spent on building the infrastructure from light bulbs alone. So H.J. Rogers went bankrupt. The people who bought the utility from him went bankrupt. And the people who bought the utility from them went bankrupt too.
Okay, so what are we looking at now? What does our grid look like now compared to that?
Well, like I say, today it is a national grid. It's also, we also generate power in a really different way. Historically, power generation was done on a very small scale. So you had one generator that was powering a neighborhood or that was powering a small town. But as you got an ever-increasing amount of demand, what you found was that it was a lot more, it was economically better to produce electricity in bulk. So today we have these plants that can power millions of homes at a time, and they are located really far away from the people that actually use that power. There's a power plant in southwest Kansas that is trying to expand and become larger. It's a coal-fired power plant, and there's a big controversy around it. But this power plant is in the middle of this part of the state that I think it's something like 200 miles to get to the nearest town with 30,000 people, but it's going to produce enough electricity to power millions of homes, and that's because electricity is meant for 7 different western states. It's going to be shipped all over. So that's a big way that our electricity system has changed. And the other thing is that we just use so much more electricity than it's even hard to comprehend. The only reason that utility companies started to become profitable in the 1920s was because they made this concerted effort to invent their own demand. So they set out to kind of develop things that people could use electricity for besides light bulbs. So they invented the electric toaster oven and the electric curling iron. And I'm sure you've seen, Desiree, that a lot of small towns, even around the turn of the century, had like electric streetcar lines, right? Mm-hmm. That's actually, in a lot of places, they were owned by the utility company because the utility company was trying to come up with something that people would use electricity for during the day. They invented this whole demand, and we got this increasing cycle of ever-growing demand year after year. And today, electricity is actually, we use more energy to produce electricity in this country than we do for anything else, including transportation. Electricity is our number one use of energy.
And I think let's talk about that. How reliant are we right now on fossil fuels?
When it comes to electricity, mm-hmm. Quite. Most of our electricity is produced by either natural gas or coal power. I think nuclear power accounts for about 20% of our electric generation. And I want to say hydroelectric power is about 8%. And pretty much everything else is coal and natural gas. There's a tiny little sliver that goes to wind and solar, but I think that wind is something like less than 3% and solar is less than 1%.
I want to say we a lot of the time, but are you talking just about the U.S. or is it sort of similar in Canada?
When I'm talking about statistics like that, I'm talking about just the U.S., mm-hmm. but it is fairly similar in Canada. In fact, you guys are part of, we use kind of the same grid. The North American grid system is kind of all interconnected.
Right.
And this is, you'll like this actually. So our grid system is separated into different parts. And the two main parts are the Eastern Interconnect, that's everything east of the Rocky Mountains, and then you have the Western Interconnect, that's everything west of the Rocky Mountains, and then you have two other subsections of the grid, which are Texas and Quebec.
That's funny on so many levels.
It really is, yeah, and there's absolutely no technological reason why that is necessary. It's just totally a cultural thing in both cases.
Interesting. So how much energy do we use total? You use the phrase in your book, quadrillion, and
yes.
I have never actually heard that term before.
It's a great big number, isn't it? It's really, really hard to wrap your head around. And, you know, my editors kept saying, well, you have to have numbers in here so that people can see this. And I feel like it's really hard to take that and actually conceive of it as something, you know, that actually means anything to you. I had a physicist who I talked to, like, trying to come up with, you know, how can we actually describe this to people so that it makes sense and it has a more visceral sort of feeling to it. And what we ended up coming up with is that we use enough energy every year that we could, you know, if you could light a fire underneath of the Great Salt Lake and boil it away dry twice, and that's how much energy we use.
That is a large number. and that is hard to wrap my head around, indeed.
Yeah.
So, and even better, as you said, our usage is increasing. So how much is it increasing?
It depends on the year. It's kind of one of those things where if you look at the charts, you'll see like little fluctuations up and down, but over time, it just keeps going up. So I believe we're expected to increase, I want to say it's something like increase electricity, or excuse me, energy use by like 20% over the next 30 years. I could be off by that, but it's just this constant upward scale. And to kind of give you an idea about how much electricity we use, since the 1970s, houses have become just exponentially more energy efficient. We now build them tighter. We build them with more insulation, you know, provide us what the services we want for less energy. But if you look in the U.S. at how much energy we use in the housing sector, it hasn't actually changed since the 1970s. In fact, it's gone up just like a tiny little bit. And the reason for that is that during that same time period that our houses became more energy efficient, the things we plug into those houses skyrocketed. And today we have, you know, more appliances, more TVs, more computers, and all of that stuff kind of ended up negating that energy efficiency gain we got from building the houses better.
So what you're saying is there are many, many problems.
There are many, many, many problems.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm joined by Maggie Kurth-Baker, science editor at boingboing.net and author of Before the Lights Go Out, which explains just how messed up our energy systems really are and where we could go from here. So you said in your book that basically, that if we seem like we're making this all up as we go along, it's because we are. So what does that mean?
Yeah. So before I started really thinking about energy, I kind of had this idea of like, well, we've got this system and this system works. And so when we're thinking about changing the way we make and use energy, we're talking about taking this, you know, great stable system and replacing it with something that's risky. And as I started doing the research, what I found is actually that that's not the case, that the grid that we have is not some kind of ideal system. It's something that evolved. It wasn't designed. And, you know, as I mentioned before, it kind of evolved in the hands of people who didn't necessarily know what they were doing. And it just kind of got pieced together in this weird little patchwork of different people's projects. It's like this house that's been remodeled or remuddled, as my husband likes to call it, over the course of 100 years. And it's actually surprisingly precarious in its current state. So I mentioned that electricity, to make the grid work, we have to have this almost perfect balance between electric supply and electric demand. And that doesn't manage itself. We have people all across the continent working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, making sure that balance is maintained on a minute-by-minute basis. And, you know, we have to have those people working. Otherwise, the entire system wouldn't work and you'd end up with blackouts everywhere.
Okay, so let's say that we do absolutely nothing to change any of these systems at this point.
Uh-huh.
What happens?
What happens is that I think we're going to have change, whether we like it or not. And this is I think is another interesting thing that I had not really considered until I started doing the research, because we have more going on than just us trying to make decisions ourselves. There are these outside forces kind of working against what we currently have, and that would be things like the effects of climate change, which can impact how well the grid operates because of, you know, you have some kind of severe storms come through, you have changing weather patterns, all of that affects grid operation. Then you also have, you know, the rising cost of oil, which is going to lead to changes in how we use energy. And what you kind of end up seeing when you look at these risks that we have kind of floating nebulously around us is that those risks are going to produce changes. So what we're kind of left with is this decision not between changing and not changing, but between making changes that we control versus having change happen to us. And, you know, from my perspective, both of those things are going to be expensive. Both of those things are going to cost us a lot of money, and they're going to be hard, and they're going to, you know, make big changes to the way that we live. But ultimately, we're usually better off if we can control what happens to us than if we just kind of take what comes.
Now, you repeatedly, you pull out a lot of numbers in the book. So where are all those numbers coming from?
So the numbers, for the most part, are coming from the Energy Information Administration of the U.S. government, which has a website. And in the book, in the footnotes, I actually have links that you can follow and kind of see where some of this stuff is coming from. And they have all of this data that they collect every year, and it usually takes about a year and a half to process. So the data from, I believe, 2010 came out last summer. And they have just, you know, they keep massive amounts of statistics, and it's incredibly hard to work through. This is actually one of the things I find really frustrating, is that there's not very good information design at that institution. So you have the same data in like five different places, but packaged differently. So you don't necessarily understand the full complexity of, you know, one statistic until you right. have looked at it in all five places. They actually have a guy, you know, people who are employed by the EIA that me as a journalist can like call up and have them help us find things, because it's that difficult to track stuff down on the website.
Well, of course, the reason why I ask that is because people always want to know, well, how do you know exactly?
And I think you have to assume some measure of error in huge numbers like that. But these are things that are coming from, you know, they're coming from the Department of Energy. They're coming from utility companies that report to the Department of Energy about their production and their usage and what their customers are using. So all of this stuff is coming from, you know, places that have various reasons to want to get that right.
Well, I liked something that you pointed out at the beginning of your book. Even if for some reason you don't believe in climate change, we should all be able to agree that improving our energy efficiency is important for other reasons, like money.
Right, like money. And this is one of my favorite stories. And I had not really even thought of it until I went down to talk to the Climate and Energy Project, which is a nonprofit in Kansas, where I'm from. And they were telling me about these focus groups that they'd had to kind of find out what Kansans thought about energy and what they thought about climate change. And they kept having over and over these guys who thought climate change was a socialist plot. But then when you asked them what they thought about energy, these same guys had swapped out their light bulbs for CFLs. They were driving a Prius. They were excited about wind power. They were interested in like what they could do at home to generate energy. So it was just this great moment of realization that if I'm actually going to communicate with people, I have to think about not just telling them why I think this is important, but I have to think about how I'm going to communicate with them on their level also and say, okay, you think it's important for this reason. I think it's important because of climate change and limited fossil fuel supplies, but let's work together and figure out what compromises we can come to where there are things that we both agree on and we can start getting stuff done.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back to talk more with Maggie Kurth-Baker, science editor at boingboing.net and author of Before the Lights Go Out, Conquering the Energy Crisis Before It Conquers Us, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and today I'm speaking with Maggie Kurth-Baker, science editor at BoingBoing.net, one of the most widely read blogs in the U.S. She's also the author of Before the Lights Go Out, which details how our energy systems really work, and just how worried that we should be, and how it is possible to fix it. So one of the issues that we're facing with the energy grid, and you cover the energy grid a lot in your book, is that it has a hard time handling the power that comes from things like wind and solar because they are so variable. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so, you know, like I say, the grid evolved, and it co-evolved with these sources of energy that work very differently from wind and solar. So to varying degrees, everything that we're used to thinking about for energy, natural gas, coal, hydroelectric power, nuclear power, they're all controllable. You know, you can say, we're going to make X amount of electricity at X time of day. And that ends up being really important because, as I mentioned, you know, there's this constant, like, little fluctuations of making sure supply and demand are balanced out over the entire grid. And that's kind of hard. It's a hard job to do. And you often have to actually call up these power plants and have them produce more or produce less. So there you have this already kind of unstable system. And then you have wind and solar power that obviously produce power in a really different way. You know, you can't determine, you can't just say that wind farm is going to produce a certain amount of electricity on this day at this time, because you don't necessarily know what exactly the wind is going to be doing. And if there's not enough wind, you can't have that power plant produce more power than it is capable of doing. So this ends up adding a tiny little bit more instability to this already unstable system. And it's not a huge problem. It's not something where we need to, you know, completely abandon wind and solar. But it's something that becomes a little bit harder to manage the more wind and solar we add to the grid. So I've had several experts tell me that we can get between 20% and 30% of our capacity from wind and solar before we're going to have to make big changes to the way that the grid operates so we can accommodate that, so that those little instabilities don't add to the already existing instabilities of the grid system.
We have a question from Lacey.
How has the increase in solar and wind power offset the increase in our overall power usage?
It does not really, because wind and solar, while they're increasing at incredibly high rates, aren't increasing as fast as our demand for electricity is. So I know that people have pointed out, like, over the past decade, we've just got hundreds of percent increases in solar power on the grid. I mean, just huge. But again, you're starting from nothing, and we're still at less than 1% of our total capacity being from solar. And meanwhile, you know, we're up a lot more than that in demand for electricity. So one of the things that's going to be really important to making our grid work in the future is getting that ever-increasing demand under control. And that means energy efficiency. That means finding ways to get these services we want, these comfortable, clean, convenient lives. How can we get those while using less energy to get them? Because we can't just keep forever increasing the amount of energy we have if we want to actually maintain that balance and make our grid work better.
Maybe we should talk about how exactly wind power works.
You mean, like, just in terms of how the turbines work?
Yeah, how do we get energy from it? Because I don't think wind power and solar power, we talk about it a lot, and we know it comes from the wind and the sun, and not much more than that.
Yeah, so wind power actually works a lot like the other kinds of power we're already used to. I mean, it's basically about how you take this So generators, let me actually step back a step here. You generate electricity. You're not actually generating anything. What you're doing is forcing electrons to move along through conductive metal. And this works because conductive metal, you know, you're all familiar with sort of how an electron, or excuse me, how an atom is set up. You have the nucleus surrounded by this cloud of electrons. And in conductive metals, those electrons aren't really tied down to any one nucleus. So you kind of have this river, again, where the nuclei float like buoys in this river of electrons, and the electrons just kind of move along past them. And you get the electrons to moving by having conductive metal moving inside in between magnets. And you get that movement, that kind of just, it's a physical thing. That happens because of, you know, you kind of have to get energy of motion happening somehow. So something like coal or natural gas and nuclear power are all about how you boil water into steam and use that steam to turn a turbine, and the turbine moves the conductive metal through that magnetic field and you get the electrons moving. Hydroelectric power and wind power are very similar in that, you know, you don't have to boil water, you don't have to make steam. Instead, you just have something directly turning that turbine. So in hydroelectric power, it's the movement of water. In wind power, it's the movement of wind. Solar power is a little bit different, and it's kind of, I think probably the best way to describe it without getting extremely technical is to just sort of say that, you know, all these other sources of energy are a lot like analog, and solar is a lot like digital in terms of how it's turning, how it's getting those electrons to start moving. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but I think that's a good analogy to talk to people about it with.
Oh, that was brilliant. That was possibly the best explanation I have ever heard of that. Thank you. So how do we make wind and solar work for us? How do we balance the variability and the other issues?
There's a lot of different ways to do this, and I think we're going to end up using a combination of many, many different things. One of the big things is that we need to have more storage on our electric grid. Right now, we have basically none, and that's something that surprised me. It's something that has surprised a lot of people that I've talked to, because we're so used to, you know, just having all these batteries in our lives. You know, I'm sitting here with my computer on my lap and this battery warming my legs, and there's batteries in my phones, and there's batteries everywhere in my house. But we don't have batteries really hooked up to our electric grid. And the batteries that are at the scale of what you need for an electric grid are massive, like the size of a semi-truck. And they cost several millions of dollars. And the kind that is being used most commonly in demonstration projects is actually not made in the Western Hemisphere at all. You have to have it shipped over from Japan. So these are not easy things to you know, just pick up a bunch and slap them down. You know, they're expensive, they're hard to get a hold of. And so we haven't really had them built in there. And so we're trying to like figure out better ways to have this storage capacity built into the electric grid. And one of the ways that I'm really interested in is called compressed air energy storage. And this is actually, you know, you turn the entire Earth into a battery, sort of, because what it does is you have like a wind farm, and this is actually something that is kind of an issue with wind, is that in a lot of places where you have the most wind in the U.S., you get higher winds at night than you do during the day. And at night, there's not as much electricity demand, so you end up having all of this wind just goes to waste because we can't use it. So what you do with compressed air energy storage is the wind blows at night. The wind turbines are used to power an air compressor, a very large air compressor, which then pumps compressed air into porous rock underground. So you're using something like a salt dome or an empty natural gas deposit, places that kind of already held things underground to begin with.
Right.
And then the next day, when electric demand is back to peaking again, you run the entire system backwards, and that compressed air helps power a natural gas generator, which produces electricity, and then it can go flow into the grid. So that's a really interesting form of storage, and it's something that has the potential to be more cost-effective than any other kind of storage system out there, but it really depends on you having the right geology and having the right geology in the right place for a wind farm to be there. But where that can happen, it could be great. There's places in Texas that will probably have something, you know, some scale of that kind of storage going online within the next few years.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guest today is Maggie Kurth-Baker, science editor at BoingBoing.net and author of Before the Lights Go Out. So we are fairly crappy at energy production and at energy storage, and also at using the energy that does come to us efficiently.
Yeah, we're really bad at making energy efficiently, actually, too. We have, I think, this is another thing where I might get the numbers wrong, but it's something like, 50% of the energy that we use to produce electricity doesn't actually make it to us in any kind of usable form. It's lost to heat, basically, inside the power plants. And then you lose another 7% from turning into heat as it travels around the electric grid. And then we have all the waste that then happens in our homes, both from, just simple conversion of energy into heat, or from us using energy when we don't need to be using it. I think a good example of that is that, you have your refrigerator is plugged in, drawing electricity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's one of the biggest energy draws in a home. And it doesn't necessarily need to have as much energy drawing as it does in order to give you the service that you want from it, of just keeping things cold in a box. So it's, there's a lot of different things that we have where all these little stages of waste are sort of happening, both from mechanical processes and from, just things as simple as leaving lights on when we don't need them in a room.
Well, and I didn't realize before I read your book that it's really not vehicles that we need to be worrying about. We consume far more energy through our buildings than our cars.
Yeah, buildings are a huge, huge sink of energy. And it's one of those things that you just don't think about, because it's not, most people drive cars, and most people kind of have this visceral experience with gasoline. You know, Right. It's something that you're putting into your tank, you're spilling it on your shoes, it's right there. And electricity is like these little elves that live in your wall, and you just don't have to think about it. And I think that we do ourselves a disservice on that, because since we don't understand it and we don't think about it, we don't realize how much of it we're using. And we also don't realize that electricity use produces more fossil fuel emissions than vehicles do.
We have a question from Jake.
If I switch off the power bar that my electronic devices are plugged into, does that stop the energy loss as effectively as unplugging the devices?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So I am basing this on my husband is an engineer, and what he does is energy efficiency analysis for buildings. So he figures out how to make commercial buildings as energy efficient as possible for the least amount of money. And he has our house set up with systems where we have little strips that you just shut off. So my assumption is that it would probably be fairly close to completely unplugging it. I don't know for certain, though, but I would think that would be a fairly close comparison.
We have a couple of questions from Dorian.
Why are we still tied into a wired grid at all? Couldn't we be beaming electricity from space or across terrestrial distances?
Well, yes. Maybe, theoretically, possibly, someday in the future. So I love all of the awesome technologies that we're working on. Like, there's so much incredibly cool R&D stuff happening. And people keep asking me about these things that I just ended up not putting into the book at all. Things like wireless streaming of electricity. But I really wanted to have the book focus on the shorter term stuff, because I think it's easy to get so caught up in how exciting the long term stuff is that you just sit around waiting for that rather than taking action in so many ways that we could right now.
Now, there's another problem. Your book is just full of doom in many places. So if, because I have never heard of this concept, and it was vaguely depressing. So if by some chance we actually do succeed in managing to be more efficient with our energy use, we run into something called Jevons paradox.
Yeah. This is interesting. So this is an issue with energy efficiency. And it's something we don't understand real well yet, because it's been something that has been, documented and talked about since the 1800s. And basically what it is that as you introduce as you make a mechanical system more energy efficient, people will end up using that system more because they've saved money from, you know, not having to run an engine as hard or use as much fuel on that engine. And so then they'll use the engine more to just basically make up that gap. So for instance, like, you know, I buy a Prius and because I get so much better gas mileage than I did before, I convince myself that it's okay to drive more than I did before and end up using the same amount of gasoline. This is something that economists have talked about for, you know, years and years and years, but it's something that we've only really been studying in an empirical way for like 15 years. And there's really so much we don't know about it yet. What we do know is that when it comes to, there are different kinds of this thing happening. They call it rebound effect, because Jevons paradox is when you're talking about losing all of the energy efficiency gain that you made back to increased use. Rebound effect is this idea that you're going to lose some of that energy efficiency gain, but maybe not all of it. And so that's the way that the researchers usually talk about it. Because there's direct rebound effect, which is like what I talked about with the Prius. You know, you have this exact same sector of the economy, exact same technology. You know, you drive more because you got better gas mileage. And we know from empirical evidence that within that direct rebound effect, you lose 10 to 30% of the energy efficiency gains that you made to rebound. The hard thing is economy-wide rebound effect, which is like chaos theory to the nth degree. I mean, it's, you know, butterfly flaps his wings in China and everybody changes out their light bulbs in New Jersey. And what does that mean to the economy? And there are people who are trying to study it, but we don't know yet whether, you know, how much and how much we lose of our energy efficiency gains on an economy-wide scale. And we don't know whether we lose all of it or not. This is something people are still trying to figure out. And it's, you know, it's a hard thing to study. And California is often brought up as an example, but the energy efficiency gains that California has gotten, there's a lot of other factors kind of playing in there that make it hard to say, well, obviously they've beat the Jevons paradox. You know, this is, you know, they're not losing all of their energy efficiency gains to increased energy use, but there's other stuff happening in there because they don't necessarily live the way most Americans do. There's usually more people per household in California, for instance, and some other things like that. And it's really hard to just, you know, take all those different threads of the economy and tease them apart to understand how this works. But one of the things that I did run into is that there are ways around that. And they are not necessarily ways that people agree on very easily, because what most of the economists told me is that the best way to handle the rebound effect at an economy-wide level is to have some, you know, some method of putting a price on carbon that takes into account what that carbon is worth, what that, you know, those fossil fuels are worth to us in terms of their utility and in terms of their economy-wide effects on society, you know, things like healthcare and an adaptation to climate change. And if you have that built into the system, then when rebound happens, it happens in the direction of further increasing efficiency or using non-fossil fuel sources of energy, because you have this price signal sort of incentivizing people not to spend their rebound effect on more fossil fuels.
Yes.
This is a complicated thing, and I always worry when I try to explain it that it's not connecting.
No, that makes sense. So will that work?
They think it will. Because this is the other thing, is that the rebound effect isn't necessarily bad. In fact, it's part of what makes us wealthy as a society, because energy efficiency that can then be reinvested, the money can then be reinvested into the economy. That's a good thing. You know, we don't want to get rid of the rebound effect. We just want to mitigate the effects the rebound effect can have on our efforts to control fossil fuel emissions. So, you know, it's this kind of complicated game you're playing where you want the economic benefits, you don't want more fossil fuels, and what they say is the best way to do that is having a price on fossil fuels that reflects what they're actually worth.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back to talk more with Maggie Kurth-Baker, science editor at Boing Boing and author of Before the Lights Go Out, Conquering the Energy Crisis Before It Conquers Us, after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're joined by Robert Fitzpatrick, founder of Pyramid Scheme Alert, and co-author of False Prophets, Seeking Financial and Spiritual Deliverance in Multi-Level Marketing and Pyramid Schemes. He'll discuss the promises and pitfalls of pyramid schemes and how to tell legitimate direct selling from multi-level marketing scams. And we'll speak to Paul Piff, researcher at the Institute of Personality and Social Research at the University of California, Berkeley, about his research on the relationship between social class and unethical behavior. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and my guest today is Maggie Kurth-Baker, science editor at boingboing.net. Her work has appeared in magazines such as Discover, Popular Science, and New Scientist, and her new book, Before the Lights Go Out, tells the story of America's energy systems. So let's move away from the doom, and it's time for some optimism. Now, after we actually started creating a real grid, hackery and all, really, the push turned towards building infrastructure with economies of scale in mind.
Yes.
More bang for your buck, as it were. So,
yep.
But now we're actually going in a different direction and we're looking at more decentralization, correct?
Somewhat. So one of the things that we found is that increasingly there are opportunities to have more distributed generation built into our grid. And this is generation that's happening on, you know, a scale of producing electricity for hundreds of homes or a few thousand rather than millions. And the reason there are opportunities for this is because of NIMBYism, the whole not in my backyard thing. When you have this power plant out in the middle of nowhere producing energy for millions of people and, you know, you have that economy of scale, the problem is then you have to transmit it places. You have to have those power lines crossing hundreds of miles, hundreds of people's property, federal lands. And at every step of the way, you have opportunities for lawsuits and cost expenses rising out of control. And so there are several people that told me that it can actually be more expensive to build those transmission lines that feed a power plant than it is to build the power plant itself. And that's where we get some opportunities, because distributed generation doesn't require as many of these power lines, these transmission lines. It's closer to the people who are going to be using it. And because it is smaller, then you have the opportunity to capture some renewable resources that we can't capture at that massive economy of scale size. We are basically, according to the Department of Energy, we're basically out of good places to build huge hydroelectric dams in the U.S. We're never going to have another Hoover Dam because we have no place to build another Hoover Dam.
Right.
But we have lots of little places all over the country where you can have smaller scale hydroelectric power that doesn't involve building dams, that doesn't involve flooding out valleys. It's based on what's called run of river hydro. So you'd have, you know, like a falls built into the river, or you'd make a cut in the river that would take some of it through a power plant and then back into the river again. Those are cheaper to build. They change the environment less, so they tend to be something people are more comfortable with you building. And they allow you to use water resources that you could not use at a very large scale. So the state of Kansas, if I can go back to Kansas again, right now I think in Kansas every year they generate enough hydroelectric power to power like 800 homes. I mean, it's just piddling, you know, because it's the Great American Desert. There's not a lot of water resources. But if you can build and hydroelectric power at this slightly smaller scale, this kind of mid-scale between, you know, everybody for himself and massive thing, then Kansas can really increase the amount of hydroelectric capacity it has. It has the potential that the state could be producing hydroelectric power for something like 300,000 homes. It's a big increase. It's not enough to, like, you know, oh, Kansas is off of coal power if we do this. But that increase makes a difference in a state that is almost entirely coal power. You know, it makes a difference in terms of public health. It makes a difference in terms of fossil fuel emissions. And it's a really good opportunity that we wouldn't have without that NIMBYism leading to distributed generation.
We have a question from the chat from Bytor.
What do you think of Jeremy Rifkin's idea of a distributed electrical network with generation facilities in people's and businesses' basements, though perhaps not hydrogen-based?
I think that the general idea of what he's talking about makes sense. I think, though, that we're not likely to end up with quite that distributed of a scale. Because, again, you still have those economies of scale benefits. You know, it's there's still a benefit to producing electricity in bulk rather than house by house. And so what I'm talking about with the scale of distributed generation, it's akin to like a farmer's market. You know, you and I could plant a garden in our backyards and we could grow a lot of great food there, but our chances of being able to feed our entire family for a whole year based solely on what's in that garden are pretty slim. And it's going to cost us more in terms of money and in terms of energy to produce food. But at the same time, you know, you have the giant grocery store out on the edge of town that you may not really like the choices that you have there. So you have the farmer's market where you can pool resources, you can share access to these different things, but you have more choices than you would have out at the big standardized industrial supermarket. So that's kind of what I'm talking about when I talk about decentralized generation, is having more electricity being generated at that kind of farmer's market scale, you know, the scale of a neighborhood or a part of town or even a small town or region of a state even, rather than on a multi-state basis.
Well, and now one of the ways that you wrote about that people are doing that is cogeneration.
Yeah, cogeneration is really neat. So this is actually something that is probably happening at the place where you went to college. It's really, really common on universities, where you basically produce heat, steam heat, with a side order of electricity at the same time from the same generator. Because as I mentioned, the generators, electric generators, are terribly energy efficient, and they turn a lot of that energy that you want to become electricity just becomes heat. These systems capture that heat and actually use it for a useful purpose. And so you get big increases in energy efficiency. So more of the energy that we're sticking in comes out the other end in something that's useful to us. And these things are operating all over the U.S. right now. They're a really small portion of our energy generation, but they could be bigger, you know, particularly if you were talking about, you know, places where you can have a power plant relatively close to town. You could use that for steam heating, for district heating, you know, things like that. So there are definitely opportunities for that combined heat and power system.
Now tell us about the Medelia model, because I love it.
It's such a great story. So there's a small town south of Minneapolis. It's just out in the prairie of southern Minnesota. And there's a woman there named Linda Meschke, who is this good old gal farmer. You know, she's been farming for like 30 or 40 years, and she's not liberal in any sense of the word. But she has become this driving force behind a plan to produce biofuels on a small scale, you know, on that kind of distributed generation basis in this small town in southern Minnesota. And the reason she got involved in this is actually for really incredibly practical reasons. You know, this is part of that whole, there are other reasons to care about energy besides climate change thing. She looked around and saw the problems that we were having with water quality and soil quality on farms that are really driven by this model of growing, you know, corn and nothing but corn on the same land year after year after year after year after year. What you get is soil that blows away in the breeze, that isn't very nutrient dense. I think something like 8 vertical inches of Iowa have gone missing since the dawn of corn farming in Iowa. Yeah, it's amazing. There's actually there's a rest stop in Iowa where you can see this in an art, public art installation that shows you like how much topsoil has been lost. And so she was really wanted to preserve the future of farming, didn't want farmers to hurt themselves in the long run, and so started looking for ways to incentivize economically people growing plants that would be better for the soil and better for water quality. So things that are native, so they wouldn't require as many inputs of fertilizers and pesticides to survive, and things that were perennial. So you have these, you know, very strong networks of roots growing through the soil and strengthening it and holding it in place. And so that led her to biofuels. So trying to grow prairie grasses on marginal land and along the lines between creeks and drainage ditches and turn into a product that they could either get paid for or use to offset their own costs on their farm. So it's a really cool system, and it's not, you know, not totally in place yet. It's something that she's been working on for like a decade. But the University of Minnesota last year started some of the first real world trials of this with a system that you know, it's basically the size of like a small camper trailer, and they haul it from farm to farm, and farmers can use it to produce basically the equivalent of like heating oil from just scraps of stuff and from the prairie grasses that they grow.
You're tuned into Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking with Maggie Kurth-Baker, science editor at boingboing.net and author of Before the Lights Go Out. So one of the biggest obstacles around changing our energy habits is that right now, being energy efficient is often far more difficult to do than not being energy efficient. And that's individually and institutionally, as a society and such. So it often involves giving up a certain amount of comfort and convenience, or it costs more. But in your book, you talk about different ways that are being introduced to make it easy for people, like making energy efficientness the default setting.
Right, yeah. And so this is something I think is really important, because when I did this research, I came to really believe that the solution to our energy problems is not something that's going to be solved on an individual lifestyle choice basis. You know, we have this whole 101 ways to save the planet mentality, but that's not what's really going to fix things. Because when the systems incentivize the wrong choices, people aren't going to make the right choices because they don't want to hurt themselves. You know, the David McKay's Energy Without the Hot Air is just an amazing book. If you've not read it, you need to read it. It's great numbers wonkery that is just fabulous. And one of the things that he says is that the average American uses twice as much energy as the average European. But if you actually look at why this is, it's not because they're better people than us. It's not because they're just oh so much more green. It's because they have these systems that their lives are built around that allow them to use less energy without having to sit down and really think about it like we would have to if we were going to use less energy. So an example of this is transportation. You know, I can walk out my front door right now and I can get on the number 6 bus in Minneapolis, and I can go pretty much anywhere in the city I want to go. And also, we have this incredible bicycle infrastructure in Minneapolis. You know, they plow the bike trails, and I can get on a bike trail and ride to my in-law's house 30 miles away, crossing streets like 3 times. And it's amazing. But that's not how most Americans live. That's not what most Americans have access to. Making the choice to have one car and drive less means they can't access their jobs. They can't access the services they need and want. They can't really participate fully in their communities. And as long as that's the choice people have, why would anyone try to use less energy? So we have to change these systems. We have to change how the infrastructure works if we want people to actually make those individual choices. You know, this is the big thing I've really been pushing with this book, is that energy is not sources, it's systems. And if you're not thinking of the systems perspective, you're not going to understand what the problems are, and you're definitely not going to understand the solutions.
And that's one of the things that, it's yet another problem. It's not just the idea that there are all these other things to change. It's also perception, because you can see when you're recycling, you can see what you're recycling, but we don't really see energy. It's a lot less tangible, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's again, one of those things where having that information matters so much. That's actually why they've had such good success with some of those utility programs where, you know, they have like a smiley face or a frowny face on your bill to tell you whether you've used less or more since the last month. Or some places will tell you, like, you know, here's how much energy you use this month. Here's the average of what your neighbors are using. So you kind of create this competition, but then you also are adding information into this system that just doesn't have information available to people. And when you give people that information, what you find is that they make efforts to use less energy, but they can't make those efforts if they don't know how much energy they're using to begin with.
We have a question from the chat from Marie Claire.
A lot of concepts related to energy are difficult to explain, so we use a lot of analogies, for example. Are there any issues with the way we usually talk about energy?
There are definitely like individual analogies I have problems with, but I think that in general, trying to put this into analogies is a good thing. And one of the things that I have talked to scientists a lot about is that when you're trying to put these analogies together, you're going to find that, you know, you're maybe only 95% accurate in terms of like, you know, the technical details. But if you have an analogy that's not totally perfectly right on the science, but more people understand the science, you're better off than an absolutely perfect detailing of the data that nobody understands. You know, it's kind of this trade-off, and you kind of have to have a little bit of a balance with that. And that's actually one of the things that, you know, I'm incredibly grateful to all of the scientists that helped with this book. You know, I was sending analogies off to people to be like, is this close enough? Is this going to get across the information as good as it possibly can? Because that's a hard thing to do. You know, creating an analogy is not an easy plan.
So what's your strategy, Maggie? After all of this information that you've researched and after all the work you've done, if you were the queen of North America, let's say, yay, Commonwealth, after, what would your energy policy be?
So, you know, there are so many individual changes that I would make if I were queen of the universe. But I think that, you know, if we're talking about like the one change that would make the biggest difference, have honestly come to believe that it would be the more accurate pricing of fossil fuels. And this is something that I, you know, 3 years ago, I would have vehemently disagreed with myself on. But that is really what we need. And like, whether that's coming through cap and trade, whether it's coming through carbon tax, I don't know the right answer for that. And economists will debate that back and forth forever. But some kind of pricing system is what you need to do to add the information into the system so that people don't have to be sitting around thinking, you know, am I making the right choice about energy and this not knowing anything about how the energy works, where this product came from. Instead, you can just see, well, is that expensive? Is that option cheap? I guess I'll go with the cheap option. You know, that's a much easier thing to do than to try to walk around with some kind of app on your phone figuring out what's the most green product you can possibly buy. And, you know, having that information embedded into the system is how you kind of start to get this cascade of changes where suddenly it makes more sense to put in wind and solar in a lot more places. Suddenly it makes more sense to make these changes to the grid that we need to be making for many reasons so that we can integrate that wind and solar. You know, it creates a cascade of change. And it is also, I think, more reasonable just on an economic basis, because if you look at how we price fossil fuels today, we're only talking about the very, very simplistic world of supply and demand, and economics is so much bigger than that. And right now we're completely ignoring like all of these extraneous costs that we have to pay for. And we're also ignoring the fact that this is an incredibly powerful fuel source. You know, we like fossil fuels because they were so much more powerful than anything that came before them, but we don't value them like they're powerful. We value them like they're worthless. And as long as we're doing that, we're not going to get the kind of changes we need.
Maggie, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me on. This has been great.
We've posted links to Maggie Kurth-Baker and her book, Before the Lights Go Out, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And since you're already there, maybe click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+ to keep in touch with us, and also to iTunes, so you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope.
telescope magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.